Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 121 of the Alexis Sale podcast. Mm-hmm. And, well, it's been quite a week. We teetered on the edge of nuclear obliteration Tuesday night, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And then the ceasefire on whenever it was Wednesday, which, of course, Israel immediately broke as they break all ceasefires. Truly, as you know, people often quote Gramsci, you know, that the old world is dying, the new world is waiting to be born. We are living in a time of monsters, and those monsters are Israel, the majority of its population, and its armed forces who are addicted or dedicated to genocidal, racist ideology.
Hmm.
So that's a problem. I mean, it. I don't. You know. I mean, you see many people struggling to interpret Trump, and you know, It's funny, you know. I think if you know, I mean, I think I know Starmer. I know who he is. I know where he lives. I mean, literally, I know what kind of person he is. Trump, I don't. I can't say I really comprehend. I mean, presumably he's a malignant narcissist. I mean, one person I like to watch is Michael Wolff, who seems like the kind of Truman Capote of this era in a way. You know, he's written books with Trump and so understands him. And just, you know, I mean, he says he's a malignant narcissist. And, you know, he makes people, you can see the fear, and he makes the people around him suffer, really. And you can see. And, you know, he used the analogy of, I was watching a podcast yesterday, I think about the analogy of Stalin, you know, that, you know, everybody's frightened to stop clapping first, really. That Trump is similar, that he employs a similar kind of regime, really, of fear. And you see all these creeps around him who are all terrified of him. I mean, that's what a weak person does, in a sense, is surrounds themselves with people who won't contradict him. But I guess he is a malignant narcissist. And you know, the people, I can't predict his actions particularly, but I try and do, I suppose, is draw a broader lesson from his existence. And what his existence does is, seems to me, is It highlights the flaw in, you know, what we call bourgeois democracy, this system where the mass of people have no power except to vote for two identical parties every 4 years, and that, you know, that, and they are locked out of the systems of power, and so that allows you know, psychopaths, narcissists, I mean, like Netanyahu or Trump. I mean, first of all, it allows a media that tells lies to people, which they believe it, and then they vote for people like Trump or Netanyahu, I guess. And so, you know, it's a critique, really, not just of these individuals. I mean, Biden, in his own way, was just as bad and just as evil as Trump, but it just emphasizes to me, if you're going to draw a broader lesson from this, is that we need a different way of distributing power, just a different way of governing ourselves, really. And the answer to that lies somewhere within, you know, anarchism or socialism. But, you know, it's pointless just moaning about Trump, but what Trump represents, which is the end stage of this kind of charade of democracy that we have, which is no democracy at all. So that's my 2 cents worth. That's what grinds my gears this week.
They say the phrase late stage capitalism a lot.
Yes.
Is that part of it too,
yeah,
do you think?
I think so, yeah. Well, I mean, late stage, I don't know what comes next, but it seems like, I don't know, I need to think more about this, really, especially. So I've got a book out, and we'll have to talk much more articulately about these things when I'm plugging it in September. But yeah, I mean, it would appear that capitalism is kind of going faster and faster and kind of consuming itself, really. And this is what comes next is, I don't know what, really.
Yeah, it could be good or bad. Or...
yeah, I'm definitely going to have to work on this. This has highlighted my...
You mentioned the Stalin comparison. Mm. It's funny because Stalin, the fear was that they'd get taken out back and shot if they yeah. didn't clap hard enough.
Yeah.
Whereas with Trump, it's a much more kind of unintangible kind of threat.
Well, you lose your job, you lose power and, you know, the access to wealth. But yeah, you're not actually going to get shot.
But the fear there, you know, the fear isn't losing your life, which makes these men and women even weaker. You know, that they're just going to lose a job.
Yeah.
They could fucking go get a better job that doesn't threaten their entire integrity and character. Yeah. Just go fucking get with your experience in the White House, you can go and get any job in any bank and make millions and millions, but they're just so desperate to be in the Oval Office, sat on those stupid golden sofas next to Trump, clapping along.
I think that kind of power presumably is kind of intoxicating if you're the sort of person that wants to do it. I mean, it is dizzying, that level of, you know, to kill people, really, and to shape the world. You know, it's a tremendous drug, and I think that's one of the reasons why we should make sure that nobody has the power to do that, really. I mean, in a sense, I suppose the one thing that this illusion of capitalism lets us do is abrogate our responsibilities. You know, the British state can, I don't know, you know, can kill people, can be complicit in a genocide. But we, you know, we can kind of say, well, that, you know, I didn't vote for them, or I voted for them and then they changed their minds. You know, I think we have to have I think one of the ways, the only way in which we can have a fairer, better world is by us all actively taking part in our own governance. And that, you know, that requires a degree of effort, really, I think, you know, but...
effort and caring and not being, you know, addicted to commerce and your telephones and actually caring about the world around you and your neighbours.
Yeah, and, making, you know, having to make moral decisions, really. Uh-huh. I mean, the other, thinking about, I mean, we did a Lexi Reacts yesterday, and I thought of all kinds of things that I wanted to talk about today, and then I've forgotten them. But one of the things that I thought was interesting, the other kind of mishigas, the other madness that we had was the whole Kanye West farrago.
Mm.
And one, of course, it was sickening to see border Jewish deputies and the campaign against anti-Semitism being allowed to speak as if they had moral authority, because these are groups who primarily act as lobby groups for Israel, and so therefore they are lobby groups for a country which is a racist apartheid country which is committing a genocide, and so I will take no lessons in morality from those fucking people. But it was funny, sometimes I watch GB News, because at least GB News doesn't have so much stuff about the fucking Artemis space.
Were you getting sick of that?
I'm an anti astronautist.
That's like my partner B. She hates it too.
Yeah,
waste of money.
Terrible. I did a thing and damaged my. Yeah, but astronauts, fucking terrible people, arrogant. Commander Tim Peake, fuck off. I'm an anti-astronautist.
What are your reasons for that?
Oh, I don't know. Just get some. Well, I think it's part. I mean, it is a waste of money. And it's a distraction, you know. No Planet B and all that. I mean, and it's just. I don't know. I just don't like.
You weren't excited to see the moon's bum?
No, I don't give a fuck about any of that shit. I mean, it was partly, I think, you know. I mean, as that great Gil Scott-Heron.
Whitey on the Moon. I was having massive Whitey on the Moon vibes this week.
Yeah,
I was singing that song to myself all week. It was actually, the timing was kind of distasteful, to be honest. They should have just held them up there for a week.
There's a film about the Apollo program, I think, which uses that poem, and in fact it didn't. Whitey on the Moon, I think, came out later, but you know, yeah, I mean, Gil Scott-Heron is a, you know, a prodigious talent really in there, but that's one of the, that's one of the greatest kind of political poems of all time, I think, Whitey on the Moon. So yeah, that's kind of what I go along with. But so anyway, I was watching GB News and they were having a thing about Kanye West, and they had some right wing guy whose surname was Miller, and they had Michael Walker from Novara, and the right wing guy just articulated my views absolutely and completely. He said that, you know, there's always this dissonance about, you know, with Wagner, or, you know, if we didn't listen to the, or watch or look at the art of people who had obnoxious views, we wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't enjoy Caravaggio, we wouldn't enjoy Shakespeare. You know, we wouldn't, you know, he said he was a fan of Wagner and, you know, all that crap about Wagner and stuff. And so he said, you know, you can't, you have to distinguish between the views of the artist and the work the artist makes. And, you know, he was a kind of absolutist about free speech. Something that I completely agreed with, and that, you know, can, and also he said that is when the government gets involved in saying who we can listen to, whose art we can enjoy, as they did because they intervened. That was, that's, you know, that's fascism, really. And then Michael Walker from Nevada was kind of put on the other side, really. I was saying, you know, the things that Kanye said were worse, and, you know, his apology doesn't count for anything. And, it was just, I know a lot, I know people on the left really are suspicious about Navarro, and so I was just shocked that he was taking that point of view, rather than, I don't know whether he didn't want to agree with a right-wing guy and wanted to make some other point, or, I mean, this, I thought it was very disappointing, and then I stopped
watching. There might be a generational issue here, because I think young folk who are, who consider themselves leftist,
they can't be, yeah,
forgiving in terms of
less forgiving,
like, because yeah. Kanye did say some fucking horrible shit.
Yeah,
I know people who've had mental breakdowns and it didn't involve them going full Nazi or anything.
No,
but my other misgivings with him are that he's a billionaire, and I don't like billionaires, and I don't think they should exist. He was married to a Kardashian, and that's a very ugly lot to throw your
yes. In
with. The stuff he said publicly with the platform he has, fully aware of the impact it would have, isn't acceptable and isn't really forgivable as easy as yeah, the other thing is his fans, it's not just that they're appreciating the art. This is my opinion. They're not just appreciating the art and separating it from the artist. His true fans, the ones who are gutted that he's not playing Wireless, would have made excuses for him, for his behavior, for his words. They would have been also not even making excuses. They would have been fully supporting and taking what he says as gospel or as a joke, as a hilarious joke and stuff.
Right.
But I agree that the government shouldn't have a say.
No.
Art is allowed. I think that should be up to audiences, and then let that make the statement it makes about our society.
Yeah.
Why have the same person headline 3 days of a festival? I don't know.
I'm really suspicious of zero tolerance, you know, because zero tolerance always, you know, I mean, they use that so often in the Labour Party. It was only zero tolerance to left-wing people. Of course, people like Neil Coyle, the MP for Bermondsey, who was, you know, suspended from Parliament for making racist remarks to a Chinese journalist, he was allowed back into the party lickety-split, but people who opposed the genocide were expelled. So zero tolerance, I think, is...
Oh, it's
dangerous,
a joke that the government they ban a mentally disturbed artist, but yeah, they enable a genocide with the other hand. It's absolutely atrocious. But I'm not a fan or a supporter of Kanye West, and
no, I don't know anything about the gentleman, really.
You know, he was he has like 40 million followers or something, and he just tweets, Hitler was a great guy, you know, stuff like that.
Well, it does sound like he was going a bit mad. But yeah, but it's an, you know, it's a debate really. But I think everybody, you know, we should allow, people should be allowed to say stuff as long as it's within the bounds of the law, and then, you know, we can make up our own minds really. I'm not a cancellationist, I think. Interestingly enough, then also staying on the kind of Novara Media theme, I was on a bus going to up to the Angel. I saw Owen Jones on a Lime bike going through a red light.
Nice.
And I thought, and it sort of made me think about, I mean, I'm not immune to going through a red light.
Don't dob him in, you snitch.
No, I'm not. Oh, you think I should not say?
No, go on. It's fine.
No, it just made me think about the idea, one of the ideas which I thought was in, when you, because my dad was a communist and was also a trade unionist, the communists had this idea, which they didn't always live up to, but that their representatives should be exemplars, that you should live a better life, you should live a kind of a morally clean kind of life, really. You had to live a life that was, you know, you couldn't drink or couldn't drink to excess. You couldn't be promiscuous. You had to follow the mores of the working class, really, and you had to be a kind of an epitome of the best morality. And
do you think running a red light is a moral issue?
It's an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, I'm not. I mean, I have to say, Owen Jones has been fantastic about the genocide. And so, you know, I think that probably balances out. But it just started me thinking about the idea of the exemplar and whether that's a kind of barrier in a way to a kind of sensible discourse. You know, to what extent those of us on the left should you know, live lives of kind of moral purity, or, you know, how much that matters, really. It's not a question I particularly have an answer to, but it's just something I'd like to raise with
as a
broader listenership. I think there's kind of something in it, in a way.
Well, certainly, yes. You don't want to end up, you know, having a Chomsky moment where everyone realizes that maybe you weren't the moral compass that we were all.
Yes, he really let the side down, didn't he?
But I think running a red light, my opinion, and I'll be saying this until I get hit by a car, but, you know, I trust my eyes more than I trust a red light.
Yeah, just there was something a bit flamboyant. He seemed to be smiling and holding a mobile phone in one hand.
Okay, that's a bit much, because I'm quite vigilant when I cycle, but following the rule of law to the letter isn't my priority, because the rule of law isn't necessarily the moral guidance.
Well,
look how many 2,800 people arrested for holding a sign. You know, but my eyes, I'm very vigilant. I've got my head on a swivel. And if I see that it's safe, I give myself a green light. You know, there are exceptions.
Doing that less, really. I've started just waiting. It's usually me and one other, usually one guy on a racing bike, a fancy high end, and then people on Lime bikes or, you know, human forest bikes or whatever, just zipping past us. And they often, like, they seem to like to cycle with one hand holding their phone in the other hand.
Yes, I don't appreciate that. If you're going to take the responsibility of cycling down a public road, that's a serious responsibility. So I'm not trying to project that I'm not taking it seriously.
Yeah.
I'm wearing my cycling gloves. You know, I've got my light. My bell is always tested before I set off. I check my brakes.
Yeah.
And you give them a tighten if they need it. I don't just willy-nilly skip red lights and such. You know, I'm happy to wait at a red light as well. I'm not like doing it as a point of protest either.
No.
But, you know.
I do. You can't
trust anyone else on the roads. So you have to trust yourself and look around you as much as possible.
Well, it's about, I suppose you had
a scare recently with that old lady shouting at you. So
you're an old man. You should know better. Yeah, because I wasn't even doing anything wrong. That was the injustice about that one. I was waiting. Yeah, it was a zebra crossing, but yeah, you're an old man. You should know better.
Tuesday was quite surreal. There's few times where I'm hooked to the news all evening, like election night, you know.
Mm.
And there was a surreal feeling of, could the world end? And I knew in my back of my head the world wasn't going to end.
Yeah.
And they kept talking about taco. You know, Trump always chickens out. And no one said Taco Tuesday at any point, which was the taco thing. I don't think it was him chickening out.
No, and I wonder whether that's something that was invented by the right wing to try and make him, act more and more egregiously, really.
I think this was a long-term plan. I think he knew he was going to back out of the war, so he needed to set himself up to look like a hero. So he set this ridiculous deadline, knowing he would back out of it, but say, oh, Iran have agreed to a ceasefire, so therefore I will gracefully back down. Because this 10-point negotiation terms that Iran presented him with, apparently he got it like 2 weeks ago.
Really?
He didn't get it on Tuesday. I think it's the most outrageous thing is just the kind of language he was using publicly. It's just so unprofessional. It's so extreme. It's like the worst thing he's done, really, is how using the whole world's emotions like that, putting us all on the brink of doom.
I suppose he loves that level of attention, really. Yeah, I suppose he won't be happy. He can't be happy because he's trying to fulfill some dark hole he can never fulfill, you know, with all this behavior. I don't know whether he was, you know, the Israelis lied to him or, I don't know. I don't know I can't say I understand his motivation. Whether he's doing it of his own back, he agreed, you know, he wants to do all this shit, or whether the Israelis lied to him and told him it's going to be an easy win. I mean, that's certainly believable.
And now and currently the Strait of Hormuz has been shut down again, and they are waiting for Israel to cut out their nonsense. I want to send my love to friends and family in Lebanon. It is actually just, I thought my heart would be calloused over the last 3 years, but it's breaking again, seeing what's happening in lovely Lebanon.
Yeah, poor country. That's months. Fucking Israelis.
Israel's a poison. It's awful. The fucking worst country ever to exist.
Yes, I agree.
Fuck them.
Yeah, I agree.
Listeners at home, please support the show by joining our Patreon. Go to patreon.com/AlexisSalePodcast. You get to watch full video episodes every week of the show, apart from the weeks that we take off. And we also do an Alexi Reacts every week as well, where Alexi will watch something he did in the past and react to it, and we'll have a conversation about it, talk about the history, the context, and behind the scenes of whatever it is we're watching. This week, we did an interview he gave to the BBC on the 25th anniversary of Dr. Martin's boots, where he played the kind of fashionista character. Mm. Ironically, waxing lyrical about the history of Doc Martens. And it was actually a lovely conversation we had, and we live streamed it.
Yes, that was fun. Time.
Yeah. It was fun, actually. And there was loads of people in the chat trying to get Alexi's attention, and I wasn't showing him any of the chat. If you want to talk to Alexi face to face or via text form, once we get to 500 patrons, we will start doing Strangers on a Podcast. We might even do it monthly, where you can jump on the stream and talk to Alexi, or he will read your questions in the chat. But we need to get up to 500 patrons before we do that. So go to patreon.com/AlexisSalePodcast and support the show. While we're doing promotional stuff, Alexi, you told me you wanted me to promote on social media your upcoming show at the Barbican on May the 6th with Slavoj Žižek. But rather than me just like doing a photo on Instagram or something, why don't you tell us about it now and I'll clip it up and put it on Instagram. Yeah. So what's happening on May the 6th at the Barbican Center, Alexei?
At the Barbican, I'm interviewing Slavoj Žižek, the world's leading popularizer, I think, of Marxist thought, a leading philosopher. That's the kind of guy I am these days. That's the kind of thing I do. I've been boning up on my... I've got Slavoj Žižek. Is that... Am I a mirror there? Slavoj Žižek, a graphic guide. But I've also got his new book, which is called Liberal Fascism, which I'm going to be interviewing him about. So, interesting character. I'll say somebody who draws their references from far and wide, really, is something that I also try and do in my new book, How I Tried to Change the World by Walking Down the Middle of the Street Shouting. But I know at one point he talks about the use of irony and a kind of in jokes, and he compares the opening ceremony of the Paris Olympics in 2024 and the film Wolverine and Deadpool.
Okay.
Which is really because, and he's right. I mean, the film Wolverine and Deadpool is a terrible, terrible film. I was quite a big fan of the first Deadpool and the second one, but this third one, I mean, it's just full of in jokes, you know, about the kind of comic book metaverse or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's so tiresome. It's so annoying.
It's all fan service. The whole film was, it might as well have been called Fan Service, the movie.
Yeah, it's I don't know whether it was a success or not, but it was awful. And, you know, it's a really interesting illustration, you know, rather than using, you know, a quote, you know, to make a point. I mean, he does that as well. Obviously, he draws from, you know, Descartes or Immanuel Kant, or, you know, he draws those sources as well, and much more obscure philosophers that I've never heard of. But he also, that, you know, I think it's an interesting idea to draw comparisons from elements of popular culture, you know. So, so that's just an interesting aspect. I've started reading the book.
And this show, he'll be talking about liberal fascism.
It's his book. Yeah, I mean, I've got another copy, but they sent me a few weeks ago a sort of giant.
Ooh, like a manuscript.
Yeah, well, of course, they did subsequently send me the book. I don't know what I've done with it, but this is a... Anyway, so I've got that version of it. And, yes, I need to go back and, you know, kind of figure out what he's talking about, and so I can ask him intelligent questions. Although Robin Ince, of course, interviews everybody, said you can just ask him one question and he'll talk for an hour and a half and then you can go home, kind of thing. But I'll try and do more than that.
Are you looking forward to it? Have you met him before?
I'm excited. No.
Why do you think they picked you, or how did this come about?
Well, it's How To Academy, who are also doing my book launch on a Book Your Tickets Now, September the 9th at the Royal Geographical Society, for the launch of How I've Tried to Change the World by Walking Down the Middle of the Street Shouting.
Mm.
So they're part of this organization called Fane, who have really kind of professionalized the book launch business. You know, it used to be when you had a book launch that you if you were lucky, you publish it through a party in a bookshop with, you know, cheese cubes and white wine, warm white wine. But now what Fane do is Fane on How To Academy, which is part, they do like, I think you can buy the book as part of the ticket price. And so that's kind of handy for, you know, book sales and also for chart position. And the events I did with Miriam Margolis last year were also part of, done by Fane, I think. So they're keen, you know, and they rightly see me as a, you know, I have my own live following. I think I have people who could come see me, and also because I am in a sense, also a you know, Marxist and a popularizer, you know, in the way that Žižek is, and so they just thought it would be a lively It may be, you know, maybe the, you know, we don't get on at all.
I think it's a good pairing.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully, it's you know, yeah. So I'm very grateful to them for asking me to do it. Really.
And, do you know who's interviewing him in the Bristol show?
No, who is it? You know.
Oh, should I not tell you? They got Frankie Boyle doing it.
Oh, right,
Bristol.
Okay.
I wonder what. I think you'll bring. I think you'll do a better job than him at it. You've got a much more wiser experience.
I guess. He's one of those sort of autodidacts, Frankie. So he's very well read, I think. He just doesn't know how to analyze what he's read.
He'll get there.
Yeah.
All right. So that's at the Barbican on the 6th of May. If you're in London, come along. It's Wednesday, the 6th of May. Go to howtoacademy.com to buy your tickets. I'll put a link in the description of the podcast. Click it, lick it, buy your ticket. And then also, obviously, pre-order Alexi Sales' book. I'll put a link in the description of the podcast as well.
What other live events have we got? We've got the Diggers Festival. Have they been in touch? Do we know what we're doing there? Well, we're doing a live podcast, obviously.
Yes.
In Wellingborough
Diggers Festival.
I think I'm also on.
Go on.
No, I'm just doing the Rick Mayo Festival in Droit, which I can't remember when I'm doing that. I think it's in July. And then we've got, have they done the announcement about the big gig that we're doing in summer, or not yet. Oh, we'll sit on that one then.
If you look up Wellingborough Diggers Festival, you will find that me and Alexi Sale are doing a live podcast on Saturday, 2nd of May. And we're also live with, we're delighted to welcome Alexi Sale live with his podcast team, they say. And we're also going to be playing the rope tackle back in Shoreham again on the 30th of July.
30th of July, I think I need to put that in mind.
And it looks like a couple of days after that, we're going to be playing in London with a very special guest. And all exciting, all fun, all great. Let's have fun together. Come and ask Alexi and myself questions. All right. What else do you want to talk about, Alexi?
I've emptied.
You know
myself.
What? We've actually messed up majorly. We were meant to do our film club this week.
Oh shite!
But the world nearly ended. I think that might have just thrown us off.
Should we
track.
Do it next week then? Or,
let's do it next week. People.
All right.
I watched
it.
You watched it recently?
Well, yeah, I watched it last week because of film club. I mean, Touch of Evil.
Touch of Evil. Oh, I normally watch it the night before.
Oh, right. Well, I've seen it so many times.
You're such a good good pupil. You make me look bad. Well, I'm sorry then. I guess it's my fault. But we're going to do Touch of Evil 1958.
Mm-hmm.
Orson Welles. Next week. Forgive us. All right.
Yeah.
1985, the year you did the Dr. Martin's interview. I can't find the Doc Martin's thing on your IMDb. You did an episode of Arena that year, though. What did you do for Arena?
Was that the Hidden History of the Four Cortina?
Yes, that's right. Let's go over to the Patreon and see if there's any questions for you over there. What do you think?
Yeah.
Following up on, we got Liam in the chat on the Patreon chat room. Liam says, following up on MLK's comment on the last episode. MLK?
Martin Luther King.
We didn't have him on the show.
Maybe he's in the Patreon from beyond the grave.
Oh, yeah, maybe he is. Anyway, following up on his comment on episode 120, and given Alexi's uncomfortable relationship with comedy in the 90s, I'm wondering what he made of Vic and Bob. They seem to share the same working class art school Dadaist background as Alexei, but lacked the political edge of Alexei and the pioneers.
I loved that. The first show that they did, which was, I think, based on the stuff they'd been doing down in Deptford, the Vic and Bob's Big Night Out. I really loved that. And then I sort of everything they did after that, I thought was kind of going back to the same well, really, too much. And I think I wrote a really, which I feel guilty about now, I wrote a short story about two very thinly disguised versions of Vic and Bob, which I regret now. It's just random nastiness, you know. I hate to disillusion people, but I could be in the past just unpleasant for no reason. Probably partly just jealousy at them being so successful, you know, my career fading at that time. So it was probably just nastiness, really.
Which short story was that? I do want to give that.
It's called Nick and Tub. Oh, no. Terrible.
So you thought they kind of just kept I said the drawing story, from the actually, same well?
I thought a bit after that, the kind of deliberate. I mean, I also... Who's the other two? Who's the other two who are even more like that, really, who I never liked?
Anton Deck.
Julian Barrett and...
Noel Fielding.
Noel Fielding. Mighty Boosh.
Oh, really?
I could never see the sense in that, yeah. I remember Robert Newman, who I was friendly with for a while. He loved Mighty Boosh. I always thought it was like just kind of archly comic for the sake of it, really.
Wow.
I think Julian Barrett is a fantastic actor, actually.
I agree wholeheartedly. This is fascinating because, you know, these are the guys who were a big part of the molding of my sensibilities, comedically speaking. You know, I was a kid staying up to watch Shooting Stars was my fucking favorite show as a kid. And it was the same jokes every week. And it was kind of like comfort food. You know, you were just waiting for them to chant Eureka or, you know, bring out George Dawes and all that. I fucking loved that show. And it felt, I also loved the feeling that it felt so chaotic and unpredictable, even though they did the same jokes every week.
Yeah.
It felt like it was going wrong all the time. And, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, you can't distinguish with me, particularly in that period, between what is a genuine kind of aesthetic, artistic critique and what is just poisonous jealousy. So why isn't that me? Why can't I get my TV series, man? Why don't you fucking me?
You had three primetime fucking groundbreaking series that your name was in the show.
Oh yes, it's true, up until the late 90s, yeah.
Fame is such a...
I suppose I just wanted...
Weird.
I just wanted just me, really, you know. I just wanted just me to be nothing else. Just me on the telly all the time. Nobody else. So I say some of it's a genuine critique, I think, and some of it is just poisonous jealousy, envy.
Well, they have it bitter, envious, needlessly so. You know, you could have just enjoyed yourself.
Yeah, I know, it's stupid. I've ruined my life. I know. I've ruined my entire life with this. And yeah, you know, I've largely shed myself off it, really. Because I realized it was ruining my life. But obviously Bob Mortimer. You know, did I say about, you know, obviously Paul Whitehouse and Bob Mortimer have got that fishing program, you know. And I thought when me and Nigel Planer did
Antiques.
Yeah, Antiques, whatever it was called.
Road Trip.
Antiques Road Trip, Celebrity Antique. that maybe we could get a bit of that, you know, because we are friends in real life, that we could get a bit of that vibe going and somebody would hire us to do something. And there's no chemistry there at all. So, you know, nobody said, oh yeah, those could be the next pair of old cunts who, you know, doing stuff, saying banal things. We could pretend that we were interested in something, you know, me and Nigel, if it gets back on the telly, but nobody was interested really in, you know, so they're a pair of old twats. We can get them to fucking.
I'm sorry that didn't work out for you.
Yeah.
That would have been a sweet deal.
It would, yeah. I was, you know, I thought.
Everyone seems to have one. Paul Merton's got one with his wife and they just like go caravanning.
Caravanning, yeah. Motorhomes, yeah.
Obviously, Romesh and Matey Boy go. I'm just.
Rob and Romesh versus decent television.
Yes. But to be honest, my dream gig, like, it's so fucking painful and wholly soul-destroying just trying to make it in this acting gig, yeah?
Yes.
I fucking hate it. Like, it drives me crazy. And it's just, you just keep going because there's just this slim chance that something amazing will come along, you know? And the more, my dream gig is just to be one of those traveling food, TV people. You get to travel the world and eat food and talk about it and just improvise. Right. And that's my dream job. So if anyone out there is hiring, I promise I'd be amazing at it and I'd be really funny and charming. And I'm good at making connections with strangers and you'd get some good telly. So someone just give me that gig. I'll do it for Channel 5. I don't give a fuck. Fly me around the world, you know. Help me make like just enough money to pay a mortgage or something, and I'll sit back happy. I'll stop trying. Sorry, yeah. God, that was a philosopher, psychologist.
Yeah, that's
psychologist
that's
made, moment.
Yeah, people are comfortable.
What do they call it? Food travel television.
Don't know.
Right?
I don't watch that shit, so I don't really know.
That's the dream. I had a weird question about the Bund. I don't know. I'm not sure what the Bund is. Do you know what that is?
Yes, I do. Of course.
Okay.
I do.
Hello, lads. We love the podcast. An oasis of relief from the onslaught of awfulness happening in the world. This is from Pablo, west of Ireland. America, then.
Mm-hmm.
I've attached a link from Zateo discussing the Bund. It would be great if Alexi could talk about this in the next podcast. Pablo, west of Ireland. I'm not going to. But yeah, the Jewish troublemakers who Zionists hated, the radical unknown history of the Bund. Rather than me just reading this article, do you want to just tell me about the Bund?
Yeah, I mean, there's a woman called Molly Crabapple who's got a book out, which I do have on order. So I will know more about this once I've read it. But yeah, the Bund were essentially, there was two. The two great splits in, I mean, I'm drawing on my own knowledge now, which may not be entirely accurate, but my understanding is that there were two splits really in Jewish thought in the, I guess, in the period between the two world wars primarily, which is one was the Zionism, obviously, where you go to Palestine, you found a homeland for Jewish people there, and you ethnically cleanse the indigenous population. The other thought was the Bund, which was essentially socialist Jews who said, no, where we live is where we are. This is where our fight is. It's in Poland, or it's in Germany, or it's in France, or it's in Hungary, or that we are part of the international socialist movement, and we stand here. This is our country, and this is where we make our fight. And Jews should, you know, we have no connection with this kind of you know, country, you know, the Middle East, that we are European, and our fight is to bring about socialism. Now, in a sense, they made the wrong, you know, so, I mean, not entirely, but a lot of the racists and the cowards fled to Israel, but fled to Palestine, where they could take on a much weaker, you know, and the Bundists were.
They had a bigger fight.
Yeah, the Bundists made the wrong bet, in a sense, that they were eliminated by the Nazis, you know, in all of all of Europe, Eastern Europe and Western Europe.
Right.
And so that strain was physically, I think, destroyed by the fact that those people were murdered. And so that's why you got, as the predominant thought, you got Zionism, really, this racist apartheid ideology. I mean, there were Zionists who also fought in the Allied armed forces and fought in the resistance. It is true. So it's partly it. But those ones who, you know, but nevertheless, that racist, you know, I mean, it's, you know, as the Green Party motion, which was sabotaged, you know, Zionism is racism. And those are the ones that triumphed, really. So, yeah, there was, you know, it's a triumph of fascism in the sense that the Bund were clearly the better people. They were socialists, and they were, you know, it's a victory for fascism that they were eliminated. You know, they were central, I think, to the Warsaw Uprising, which of course was also sabotaged by Stalin. And I mean, I'll know more. That is my understanding of Bundism. But yeah, I think it'd be interesting to do a deeper dive. And once I've read that book, I will. You can talk more about it. But yes, that it's a forgot. I mean, and obviously, nobody in a sense in our media has got any interest in emphasizing that. You know, to say that there was an alternative thought, you know, strain of Jewish thought which was opposed to anti-Zionism, and the Zionists, of course, hated the Bundists, you know, and I, you know, were at the very least glad to see them eliminated.
The book's called "Here Where We Live Is Our Country" by Molly Crabapple. So these Zionists claim to be victims of the Holocaust, and that's why they need a homeland. But you're, I don't know if it was mostly Bundists who were murdered by Nazis.
Yes, it was. Of course it was. Because they stayed and fought.
Most Bundists were murdered in Nazi gas chambers, it says here, and Soviet gulags. But like, didn't the Zionists... Why is that ironic? Excuse my ignorance.
Because you'd think, because they were socialists, why would, you know, the Soviet Union want to see them eliminated? But of course they didn't. I mean, there is that terrible, which I think is true. I'm not buying. I mean, again, people may have a different point of view, can argue with me, but my understanding is that because the Soviet Red Army was on the edge of Warsaw, that the Bundists and rose up in the Warsaw ghetto and seized, you know, and drove the Nazis out of the ghetto. And what Stalin did, which is the most unforgivable thing of I think of his many crimes, was that he deliberately paused the Red Army, and they didn't attack. They didn't go into Warsaw until all the socialists had been killed or taken prisoner. Really. And I think that is maybe I'm accepting Western history there, but I think that's what happened. And so you have to say that is as bad a thing as anything, really, that you got this extraordinarily brave uprising, and you know, Stalin just ordered the Red Army to stay out of Warsaw, to not aid them until they were all killed. And it's despicable. Again, maybe somebody knows better than me and says that didn't happen, but that's my understanding, really. But it is a condemn, you know. We should.
Maybe I'll reach out to Molly herself.
Yes, that's a good idea. Oh, yeah, that's a really good idea, yeah.
But it says here, she says here, it is impossible not to see the liquidation of Gaza in the liquidation of the Warsaw ghetto.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, Pablo from West of Ireland, thanks for your question. I will be sure to ask Alexei again to expand once he's read the book. And I might even reach out to this Molly Crab Apple character. Yeah. Free Palestine, everyone. Free Lebanon. I think we need to wrap up, if you don't mind. Support the show. Go to patreon.com/ Alexi Sell podcast. Links in the description of the podcast to the Slavoj Žižek interview at the Barbican, our upcoming live shows, which have been announced, and a link to pre-order Alexi's signed book coming out in September. Anything else, Lex, you want to leave us with?
I think that'll do for now. All right. No. Okay, everybody. Bye-bye. We'll do Film Club next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Alexi Sell podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.